Patrick Mackay was a monster. And if ever he gets out of prison, I'm absolutely certain that he'll kill again.
Patrick Mackay displays all of the classic signs of that kind of offender we know as the psychopath.
It's hard to forgive a man who picks on people who are old and weak and defenseless and murders them brutally.
In 1975, the quiet village of Shawn in Kent hit the headlines because of a gruesome murder. Father Anthony Crean was killed by repeated blows to the head with an axe. It was the last in a string of murders committed by 22-year-old Patrick Mackay. Just 7 years earlier, he'd been labelled a schizoid psychopath. What I want to know is how he was able to commit such horrific crimes and why no one stopped him. I'm Fred Dinage, and I'm investigating Britain's most famous murderers. I want to know what turned them into killers, sentencing themselves to death or a lifetime behind bars.
How does a child grow into a monster? Patrick Mackay was born in London in 1952. His father, Harold, met his mother, Marion, whilst working together in South America. Marion fell pregnant with Patrick, and Harold was sacked, forcing them to return to England. Only 20 years later, Harold and Marion's son was making the news as a psycho killer.
Journalist John Pennycate studied the case and wrote a book about the man behind the murders. Let's talk first of all about Patrick Mackay's childhood, because it was a very troubled childhood he had, wasn't it?
Yes. His father was an unhappy man who'd had a very traumatic war and turned into an alcoholic and used to come home at weekends on Fridays and Saturdays very drunk and beat up his wife, Marion, and attack the little boy.
Harold Mackay worked as an accountant, a job he hated. He escaped the pressures of his everyday life by drinking away his weekly wages.
There might be such a thing as a psychopathic gene, that being somebody without scruples or morals or compunctions of any kind. It might just run in families.
Someone who got to know Patrick Mackay as a child and became involved in his family life is former police officer Amy Tapp.
We used to patrol the town and we used to go into the park, and I went in and there was Patrick in the middle of a little pond with a great big piece of cement which he was going to hit somebody else with, another boy. Boys like to fight, but this boy was very, very violent, and I took him home and I left him with his mother and hoped that that would be the end, but it certainly wasn't, because after that we used to have calls to the house and we'd go up to the house where he'd be going raving mad.
When Patrick was 10, his father died from a heart attack. Harold's final words to his son were, "Remember to be good." An ironic statement from a man who'd made his child's life a nightmare.
The boy never saw him dead, and the boy didn't go to the funeral, and therefore Patrick never had any direct evidence of his father's death. And for the rest of his life, he fantasized that his father was still alive, or started referring to other older men as Dad. Harold Mackay was a problem alive. He was a problem for Patrick dead.
Marion Mackay struggled to cope with the loss and suffered from a mental breakdown, while Patrick developed into a bully. He became violent towards his mother and two sisters, believing his mother preferred the girls to him. Policewoman Amy Tapp saw these tantrums firsthand.
If he got another boy, that boy could cry, he could shout and yell, and there was never any compassion there at all. He just was cruel, and you knew that eventually he was going to do something which was serious.
What happens to a child in the first years of their life, of course, can shape the adults they become. Someone who studied exactly what happens when things go wrong is leading criminologist Professor David Wilson.
He has what we would know as the McDonald triad of factors. So three issues in his childhood that's going to be very significant in relation to the adult Mackay is going to become. Cruelty to animals is often a good indicator. So here we would have Mackay, who'd sometimes pin birds down on the road so that they would be killed by cars passing over them. Also arson, fire starting. They like the sense of the power that the setting the fire gives to them. They like watching things unravel. And then the final thing in this triad of factors is bedwetting. We have only a little evidence about that in relation to Mackay, but he does seem to have had this very disturbed childhood that's going to indicate the type of man that he's going to grow into.
In 1964, Mackay set fire to a Catholic church, causing £150 of damage. That's £2,000 in today's money. The police decided he could no longer be ignored. 11-year-old Mackay appeared at Dartford Juvenile Court on trial for 21 charges, ranging from stealing garden ornaments to arson. He was given 3 years probation and sent home to his mother with the encouraging words, "Don't worry, he'll grow out of it." What was your last encounter with Patrick Mackay, do you recall?
One lunchtime, they asked me to go up to this house where his mother lived. And Patrick was in the house, and there was firemen, there was ambulance men, there was police outside. He wouldn't let anybody in. He'd got a can of petrol, and he was going to throw it over anybody that came in. Well, I knew that somebody had got to go in, so I went in the kitchen door. I thought, if he comes in and throws that at me, I've got to deal with it. But I called to him. Funnily enough, he came in. I said, "Patrick, sit down." Well, he sat down. And I said to him, "What's the matter with you?" And he said, "I don't want all them in there. This is my house." I said, "It's not your house, it's your mother's house." And eventually the police were able to come in while we were in the kitchen. And I think the ambulance people took him to Stone House on that occasion.
Mackay's erratic behaviour continued over the next 3 years. He spent time in approved schools and psychiatric wards. Each time the teenager was committed, he was released due to his improved behaviour or his mother's persistent petitioning.
It's easy to criticise the psychiatrists and social workers and police officers who handled Patrick Mackay, and he slipped through their sort of attention and then went away and did something else, and it was somebody else, and somebody else, and somebody else. But I mean, when he was only 15 years old, he was diagnosed by a Home Office psychiatrist as a cold psychopathic killer.
In January 1967, Mackay was due to return to Court Lee's approved school after spending Christmas with his family. Mackay was so distraught at the prospect, he made a suicidal bid and tried to gas himself.
He clearly did not want to go back into those institutions. So, for example, often he would attempt suicide. It's quite clear also that he would have his mother, Marion, advocate on his behalf so as to prevent him to go back into those institutions. She clearly wanted to give him a stable home, a stable environment, but really didn't have the psychological, the practical wherewithal to be able to deliver on that.
Immediately, she hit upon this scheme of taking her three children, her son and two daughters, back to her home country, Guyana, in South America. She went to stay with relations there. The whole thing was a total disaster. There were rows the whole time. The kids were unmanageable. Mrs. Mackay was not accepted by her family back in Guyana. And she came back after 3 weeks. It was a complete waste of time.
This upheaval caused Mackay to feel even more unsettled and excluded.
You know, one of the elements of this story, Fred, that's very rarely alluded to, though, which has an impact, I think, on Mackay the child, is that his mother, Marion, is Creole. She's from British Guyana. And so that sense of being from a mixed race at a time when England was very much a monoculture, an overwhelmingly white culture, he's neither one thing nor the other. So there's a complexity there being built up in a variety of different layers through the mental health of his mother, the alcoholism of his father, and of course this idea of him being mixed race.
When he returned to England, it wasn't long before Mackay's violence resumed. His mother and sisters were on the receiving end. He mentally and physically abused them. The 15-year-old repeatedly tried to commit suicide. He put his head over a ring on the gas stove. When that failed, he tried to drown himself under a tap. And when that failed, he stabbed himself with a bayonet.
Any psychiatrist will tell you there's a big difference between suicidal gestures, which are in a way a sort of appeal to help, so you make this dreadful self-harming gesture. I'm not convinced myself that Mackay ever did anything genuinely to kill himself. He just did suicidal things like walking along tube line tracks and things like that.
In October 1968, Mackay appeared in front of Essex Assizes, charged with the violent assault of a young boy. The 16-year-old was found guilty and sent to Moss Side High Security Hospital in Liverpool.
There's no real attempt to help him develop, for example, empathy, to understand the impact that he's having on other people's lives when he's behaving in a violent way. So institutionally, nothing is really helping him because there's not enough concerted psychiatric help to deal with these underlying psychopathic tendencies.
In 1972, at the age of 19, Patrick Mackay was released from Moss Side Hospital back into society. This was despite the fact doctors had warned that he was dangerous and a schizoid psychopath. It wasn't long before they were proved right. I'm Fred Dynage and I'm investigating the case of Patrick Mackay. Certified a psychopath at the age of 15, he went on to kill at least three people.
By the age of 19, he'd spent the past 8 years in and out of mental institutions.
The system had failed him. Now Mackay was about to exact his revenge.
The troubled teenager found it difficult to form relationships. Carmelite priest Father Crean saw an opportunity to befriend this lost soul, hoping that patience and kindness would cure his violent ways.
Patrick was clearly a very disturbed character to almost everybody who met him. By the time he met Father Crean, he was in his sort of mid-teens, and he was drinking, as his father had done before him, and Father Crean used to buy him drinks in the pub, which made him, in Patrick's eyes, a very good friend indeed. But of course, Patrick responded to this friendship by eventually robbing Father Crean of a cheque, which he cashed in the local bank, which set up a whole set of consequences. Father Crean intervened with the police not to press charges, but the police decided that he ought to be charged, and he was charged. He was ordered to pay compensation and pay the money back.
Mackay couldn't resist his criminal impulses, stealing money and food and cigarettes and often breaking into people's homes. He was well known to Ken Tappenden, who at the time was a detective inspector working with Kent Police.
He would befriend priests and vicars where he knew that there was an easy touch, really, that they would give him money and he would go off and he would eat. And he had a propensity to buy scotch as a drink. He wasn't always a drunkard, but even in his early days, he did like scotch. And when he got into scotch, he got not violent, he got very excitable in his own behaviour.
Mackay drifted back to London and found the normal family life he'd always craved with the Cowdrys in Stockwell.
He was drinking companions with the sons, and they took him back home. And with a dad and a mum, there was a family unit such as he hadn't had for the best part of a decade. And he called the Cowdrys Mr. and Mrs. Mum and Dad. And Cowdrey used to say to him, "I'm not your dad." And he said, "Yes, you are. I adopted you." This was a substitute family. Well, he took absolute advantage of the Cowdrys. He used to go there and doss and sleep time after time after time. But I think it was the nearest Mackay came to a proper, normal, friendly relationship with people of his own generation and his parents' generation.
It was Valentine's Day 1974. Mackay had just been released from Tooting Bec Hospital after yet another suicide attempt. It was on that very same day his violent rage inflamed. He was to become more terrifying than he'd ever been before.
He virtually didn't bother looking for work and went on a spree of mugging. Basically, handbag snatching old ladies in Chelsea. Chelsea is full of fairly well-off old ladies. Sadly, many of them widows. Sadly, many of them living on their own. Absolutely fair game for a big strapping lad like Mackay, who used to go up to them and say, "Can I carry your shopping?" And things like that. Or various silly ruses to get into their flats and houses. He stole hundreds and hundreds of pounds that way.
84-year-old widow Isabella Griffiths had been dining out for lunch and shopping with friends when she returned home to Cheyne Walk in Chelsea.
He first met her when she was carrying two very heavy bags back to Cheyne Walk. Basically, he carried one and she carried the other. He didn't kill her on the first occasion, he befriended her. I think it was about 2 weeks later, he went back past the house again and he knew she was in because he saw the light on.
He goes knocking on her door to ask if she needs any shopping done on her behalf. She has the latch on the door, opens the door to Patrick, sees it's him and says, "No, I don't need any shopping done for me today."
Mackay was enraged. He burst through the door, breaking the chain and swiftly strangled the 84-year-old lady in her own hallway. Mackay then moved Mrs. Griffith's body into the kitchen and wandered aimlessly around her home.
He always sat down and thought, "Where's my life leading me?" He used to talk like that. "Where am I going in my life?" But he came downstairs, listened to Edward Heath on the radio. Then he thought, "No, I'm excited now." Went to the kitchen, she was still laying there. Whether she was dead or not at that time, he don't know. But he took a knife out, and I think his description was, if you take a 12-inch ruler, it's about as long as that. This was in his 46-page statement to us. And he said, "I wanted to put it just below her chest, right through the solar plexus, so that I missed the bones." And he did exactly that, pinned her to the floor with the knife.
Mrs. Griffiths was dead, but still Mackay remained in her flat and rearranged her body, or as he later wrote, "I wanted in death to make her comfortable." He tidied up, putting the crockery in the sink and closing the curtains. Mackay then headed into the night.
Why would he stay so long? Why would he not commit the crime and then get out as quick as possible?
Well, he doesn't leave. So this reveals some very muddled thinking, perhaps because he was drunk, perhaps because he was high, or perhaps because he simply liked being in an environment where he was in total control.
If this poor lady hadn't said, "No, I don't want any shopping, go away," and invited him in, would she have lived?
That is a very good question, because I think he snaps when Mrs. Griffiths says no. Her failure to allow him into her flat is, for Mackay, the straw that breaks the camel's back, the incident that pushes him over the edge.
Isabella Griffiths' body remained undiscovered for 12 days. There were no clues to identify her killer. The police had hit a brick wall. Television appeals were made, but the case remained unsolved. Mackay's violence had escalated into murder.
Here's the key thing, Fred. He's learned that elderly people like Isabella Griffiths are vulnerable. He's learned that often he can use his charm to get into their flats, to get into their lives. Again, we're dealing with the psychopathy. Again, we're dealing with the sense in which he's going to have a parasitic lifestyle. He's going to live off these elderly women that he identifies as being vulnerable.
On the 10th of March 1975, Mackay was pursuing his usual pattern of stalking elderly ladies when he met 89-year-old Adele Price returning from a shopping trip.
In this case, she lived in a flat, in a block of flats in Lowndes Square. He followed her in by shaking his own set of keys to give the impression that he himself was a tenant there and was going to let himself in.
He said he felt faint. And she said, I'll give you a cup of tea. But this is how plausible he was. He said, no, I don't want tea, just give me some water. He could be very plausible. He was always lying. Lying about his name, lying about where he came from. But he was very convincing to policemen, let alone elderly people and elderly ladies on their own.
Adele Price had no reason not to believe the nice young man, but her kindness was a fatal mistake. Mackay ordered Mrs. Price into the bedroom, telling her, I don't want any complications as I'm feeling on edge.
When he got her to her bedroom, that is when he killed her, strangled her with his left hand. I only make an emphasis of saying left or right because this is Mackay. He wanted to tell you I did it all with one hand, but he did it off the left hand. That's his weakest hand.
Adele Price had become Mackay's second victim. He'd relished in his control over the frail elderly lady. An easy strangulation for the powerful 22-year-old.
I often think there's an element in which the killer feels powerful doing that because he's literally looking into the eyes of the person he's about to kill and can see that life draining away. So the killer has given to himself the power of life and death, the power that Mackay has been desperate to have for himself since he was a young boy.
The murder of Adele Price was without motive. She was unable to put up a fight and had lost her life trying to help out a stranger. Mackay later described the killing, I felt hellish and very peculiar inside. This peculiar feeling I had for some days before and after each killing. Once again, Mackay had got away with murder.
I'm Fred Dynage and I'm retracing the case of psychopathic killer Patrick Mackay. He'd been committed to psychiatric hospitals on more than five occasions, been twice to the Moss Side High Security Hospital, been in prison on two occasions and carried out 24 muggings. Now he'd killed two elderly ladies, but Patrick Mackay wasn't finished yet.
He always had death on his mind, and he always had killing on his mind. He was a very dangerous man by now. And the Metropolitan Police couldn't get up with him.
It was the 10th of March 1975. The body of Adele Price, his second victim, lay in the bedroom where Mackay had just strangled her. After killing Mrs. Price, he took a nap, only to be awoken by the elderly lady's granddaughter on the flat intercom. Unable to contact her grandmother, she let herself in and walked up the stairs. Mackay made a quick exit.
She was going up, he was going down. She just thought he was another tenant in the building. When she got there, she unlocked the bedroom door, found her grandmother and assumed it had been a heart attack. And the medics arrived and a policeman arrived. And he was only a PC. He said, well, describe to me what happened. And this girl said, well, I unlocked the bedroom door and there she was lying there. You unlocked it from the outside? And he suddenly said, hold everything, to the ambulance guys. Don't touch a thing. He twigged that this was a murder scene. And that PC got a commendation from his superintendent for his quick thinking. It didn't occur to the girl this might be a murder.
In my research about serial killers in Britain, elderly people are the group that are targeted most regularly by British serial killers. There have been 225 elderly people at least murdered by British serial killers since 1960. What is it about the state of being elderly in our culture that makes them a suitable target for serial killers? Is it their voicelessness? Is it their powerlessness? Is it the fact that if an elderly person dies, we don't question that death, but simply accept it?
Again, the police had no suspects for the murder of Mrs. Price, and the crime went unsolved. But Mackay's violent ways continued, assisted by his obsession with Nazism. He'd made himself a crude Nazi uniform and, on occasions, could be seen goose-stepping and saluting to Hitler.
One of the things that Nazism talked about was how the Aryans were a pure race. Now, there's a sense in which by identifying with a pure race, there's some sense in which Mackay is rejecting that kind of mixed race background that he comes from. And also psychodynamically, he's trying to make himself scary. People will be afraid of him because so much of his life was about him being afraid of his father.
22-year-old Mackay continued to drift from place to place.
He is able to hold down jobs occasionally, so he's working, he's staying in hostels, he's staying with the Cowdrys, moving from one particular location to another location, always committing petty crime as well as whatever job he may have been able to come by.
But the usual pattern of Mackay's life was about to change.
Over the past 2 years, Mackay became good friends with Father Crean, the Catholic priest he'd once robbed. The Cowdrey family found this friendship rather strange, and the Cowdrey boys goaded Mackay that his friendship with Father Crean was actually homosexual. This angered Mackay.
What was the relationship between Mackay Father Crean? Was it a strange relationship?
No, it was a friendly relationship in the beginning, where Crean actually did try to befriend him and try to give him food, if you like to put it in simple terms, try to give him a drink, try to make him feel as if he was wanted at the kind of nun's home, the priesthood.
There is absolutely no evidence that I or my co-author saw to suggest that there was a homosexual relationship between Father Crean and Patrick Mackay. However, his friends, the Cowdrys, turned it into a bit of a joke, the fact that he'd befriended a single, supposedly celibate Catholic priest, and made crude and disparaging jokes about his supposed relationship with Crean. According to Vic Cowdrey, this threw Patrick into an enormous rage.
On March the 21st, 1975, just 11 days after the death of Adele Price, Mackay decided to visit Father Crean in Shorne, a small village in Kent.
He admitted himself to Father Crean's cottage. Father Crean wasn't there, he was outside somewhere. Mackay waited. Eventually, the father came back in and saw Mackay waiting for him. He sensed aggression or something in Mackay and was very, very scared. And Mackay went and grabbed him, and they grappled and actually fought in the hallway of this house. And something triggered this manic frenzy in Mackay.
Father Crean broke free and ran to the bathroom, closing the door behind him. Mackay chased after the Catholic priest, seizing an axe from a toolbox in the hallway. He burst through the bathroom door, knocking the terrified priest into the bath.
He then produced a knife and started viciously stabbing the old man. He stabbed him in the neck over and over and over, and then he tried to stab him in the head. And this broke the knife, or bent the knife. Mackay then reached for the axe and then set about Father Crean with the axe, crashing it into his head and his face.
This, in fact, is the axe.
That is the axe. That's the one that actually killed Father Crean. He really massacred his head. In fact, when we went to the post-mortem and the top of the skin was taken off his head was absolutely mashed inside. And this axe, and it still does to today, has got particles of brain still on it, as you can see on that ring. The ferocity of the way he struck him was quite incredible He must have really used all his strength, and he was strong. He was strong at 17.
The wounds in Father Crean's head were so devastating, it left his brain exposed. But he wasn't dead.
He was obviously not going to live for very long, but apparently he reached up with his hand to his exposed head. Within a short time, lying in this mass of blood in this blood-stained bathroom, he died. Mackay then weirdly put the plug in the bath and ran the bathwater so that the dead body of this Catholic priest was floating about in the water. And Mackay stayed there on and off for about an hour, watching the body floating in the bath.
Undoubtedly, he knew he was dead because of the state of the man's body, including his head, of course, and that involuntary movement. But he wasn't content just with that. The bath was full of water that he ran, and he then bobbed the priest up and down for nearly an hour whilst he opened the window, looked at a bonfire in the priest's garden. And again, he said it was just a wonderful experience. And the bath just ran completely red with blood.
You'd think he'd have run 100 miles to get away from such a revolting crime scene, but no, he stayed there. This was the morbidity of his psychopathy.
Mackay eventually left Father Crean's house, placing the axe back in the box, and visited his mother for dinner. He then went to the cinema in Gravesend before returning to London on the train.
Was he insane?
I don't think he was insane. Anybody who repeatedly commits murder is clearly not batting on the same moral wicket as you and I. Those psychopathic traits don't make him insane. And I think a lot of the roots of Patrick Mackay's murderous adulthood were sown when he was a very small boy by having an aggressive alcoholic father who regularly beat up Mackay and also Mackay's mother. We see in that boy the sins of the father being repeated in the child.
Psychopath. I wouldn't put him down as insane. I would say that he could be very lucid, he could be very plausible, he knew where he was going. I think he became, if I want to use your word, insane, the moment he thought it could be you. You've got to die. And I'm not going out of this place all the time you're alive. And that's when he said, I get excited. I'm just trying to think of the word he always used. It's a most unusual word, but it meant worked up, loved it. Someone's got to die now. I've got to kill now.
Later that night, Father Crean's body was discovered by one of the nuns from his convent. She called the police, and Ken Tappenden was one of the first on the scene.
I got the first call probably about 8:45 in the evening, and all they said at that time was Father Crean had gone missing. We didn't think too much of it, and then the next call came about 10:50, and what they said then was, we haven't found him yet, but a nun is screaming down there. The police were dispatched again. And of course, when the next call was the one that we knew we were in business.
Nothing could prepare Ken and his police colleagues for what they were about to find.
All of us went. You had the very senior policeman from the county come out as well. And it was a macabre scene when we actually found him. Looking into, there was a bath of water. His brain was protruding from his head. The post-mortem revealed that his head was smashed right down to his eyes and nose inside.
Father Crean had been killed in the most brutal manner. Now the police had to find the killer, and quickly.
I'm Fred Dynage, and I'm investigating the horrific murders carried out by Patrick Mackay. He'd already killed two elderly women, and now he'd claimed the life of a third victim, a Catholic priest.
Father Crean had been brutally battered by an axe at the hands of Patrick Mackay. There was no apparent motive for the frenzied attack. At the time, Ken Tappenden was Detective Superintendent of Kent Police. It was his hunch that helped the team working on the case.
I just about 3 in the morning went back, because you start thinking, who is it? then all of a sudden I thought, that'd be Mackay, because I can remember the wild look and his eyes. And people who have the eyes of a killer, it shows.
Mackay left Gravesend and headed back to London after killing Father Crean. The police searched for him and visited the hostel he regularly used. Never in the same place, Mackay wasn't going to be an easy person to find. Or so they thought.
Someone at that hostel, one of the other inmates or one of the other people living there, remembered Mackay mentioning a family called Cowdrey. The police did an electoral register check in South London, lots and lots of Cowdreys in South London. By happy chance, the first one they went to in Grantham Road was Vic Cowdrey, and there was Mackay.
He was no trouble. When they went up the hallway and said, "You're arrested," he came fairly quietly. But of course, once they searched the place there, Cowdrey's place, under a lift-up settee, they found swastikas, they found knives, they found a sword. It was an Aladdin's cave. Cowdrey must have known about that. I don't say Cowdrey lived in fear of him, but I should think he probably slept with one eye open.
Mackay confessed to the murder of Father Crean and was sent to Brixton Prison. He was appointed a solicitor, Robin Clark.
Robin had previously acted as Mackay's solicitor when he stole the chequebook from Father Crean.
When I was sitting at my desk one afternoon, phone call from Detective Chief Inspector Lou Hart at Northfleet Police Station, saying they had an interesting client and he knew me and had asked for me, would I come along? And of course that then kicked in the saga that we're talking about today.
When you first met him and in subsequent meetings, what sort of man did you find?
He appeared to be extremely introverted. He was difficult to talk to at first until you'd got a decent rapport with him.
It was a gruesome killing, wasn't it?
It was indeed.
What did he tell you about that?
He couldn't remember too much after the event, and I think this is exactly the history with the other two killings that he did admit to. But he just lost his self-control and afterwards sat there wondering what he'd done and why he'd done it.
The police had the evidence to charge him for Father Crean's murder, but there were still other unsolved cases outstanding. And Mackay's involvement in the murders of Isabella Griffiths and Adele Price was yet to be proven.
In one of the flats where he'd robbed an old lady, he left a fingerprint on a spoon. And Superintendent Bland of the Met ran a fingerprint check because he was convinced there had to be some link between this great spate of muggings and handbag snatches and these murders of old ladies who were very typical of the victims of the other crimes. When the superintendent ran this check in the yard of this fingerprint, sure enough, up it came. Patrick Mackay in custody for the murder of Father Crean. So Bland went to Brixton to interview Mackay, and Mackay confessed, certainly to Price and Griffiths.
While in prison, Mackay told inmates of other murders that he'd committed, and this information was fed back to the police detectives.
The problem is thereafter that there were 9 other murders that are associated with Patrick Mackay, and I get the distinct impression that what happened is that the police, in an age before DNA databases, DNA profiling, simply looked through their unsolved murders and went to Mackay and said, were you responsible for this murder? Were you responsible for that death?
I think it was a time when the police had a policy of trying to clear up even crimes of murder by way of offences taken into consideration, and they lived in hope that Patrick would say, oh yes, that's one I'll have, and would own up to about 60 murders.
2 more cases stood out as having strong links to Mackay. The police decided they had sufficient evidence to charge him with the murder of Miss Mary Hines in July 1973 and the murder of Frank Goodman in June 1974.
On Miss Hines, he smashed her head to bits with a lead pipe, actually, and a lump of wood. He never really wanted to admit that one, probably because of it so gruesome. But in the end, the way he admitted it was, I killed her and it was easier than washing my socks. It gives you enough to start on. And Goodman, he ran a tobacco shop. Mackay went in for cigarettes. He said no. And with that, Goodman had to go. And he kicked the man to death on that one.
On the 21st of November 1975, Patrick Mackay stood trial at the Old Bailey, charged with five counts of murder. Was his responsibility diminished by his mental abnormalities? Or was he in fact quite sane and knew exactly what he was doing?
If he was found insane, Mackay would be sent to a mental institution where he could be treated. However, if it was believed that no one could help him medically, then prison was the only option.
You can only go to Broughton or Moss Side if you are going to be receptive to the treatment that is offered there. The object of Broughton is not to lock people up forever. The object of Broughton is to cure them. When Mackay was on trial at the Old Bailey, the judge was given evidence of all his background in Moss Side and so on. And it was perfectly obvious that he was not susceptible to treatment, that there is no treatment for psychopathy.
Diminished responsibility sets out in statute the grounds upon which the court can allow a charge of murder to be reduced to one of manslaughter where the intent to commit has come about only because of a mitigating factor. In Patrick Mackay's case, because he was suffering from a psychopathic disorder, and the prosecution allowed the allegations of murder to be dropped.
Ken Tappenden attended the trial and saw Mackay's unusual behaviour firsthand.
But there's one day there, just when going to court, and I was going down to get him remanded again, and he was wild. His mother had upset him again because we told him that she would be in court trying to get him bail. And he said, do my shoes up. And when I looked at his eyes, I had to say, you do your own fucking shoes up, mister. I'm not doing them up. Because I could see he was in a frame of mind. He had those killer eyes again.
Patrick Mackay was sentenced to life imprisonment for three counts of manslaughter by way of diminished responsibility for the killing of Father Crean, Isabella Griffiths and Adele Price. The murders of Miss Hines and Frank Goodman were not withdrawn but left open on file. Mackay was locked away, but his story didn't stop there. The press picked up on the controversial case and wanted to know how this killer had not been stopped earlier.
If Patrick Mackay had had help much earlier in his life, could all this have been avoided?
In Patrick Mackay, we are dealing with a serial killer, and therefore it's very difficult to say that I feel sorry or sympathetic for somebody who's done what Mackay has done. The kinds of background that he had when he was growing up does make one feel sorry for him, and I do get the distinct impression if more had been done with Mackay on a consistent way, we might not have been dealing with a serial killer. We may always have been dealing with a very damaged man, but I don't think he would necessarily have turned to murder.
I think the authorities, between all of us, we bred a killer. Now, that's a strong thing to say. We bred a killer. The times that they let him go to kill, because he was a monster, really, Patrick, and if he were to come free today, I'm sorry, he'll kill again.
Mackay has been in prison for more than 35 years and will spend the rest of his life behind bars.
It's very, very sad that a boy grows up like that. I mean, I haven't seen him for years and I probably won't see him, but you just wonder what sort of man he's grown into.
He did show this spark of self-awareness and self-knowledge. He knew that he was a very, very, very flawed human being. So while, for our own protection, let's please lock this man up for as long as possible until he's no danger to anybody. At the same time, let's acknowledge that in spite of his hideous background, there was another side to him.
Did he ever show remorse for the killing of the two women and or Father Crean?
He certainly couldn't understand why he'd done it. And I think this troubled him greatly to think that three people had died at his hands. And for him not to be able to say, well, it was because of A, B, C and D. But I think you'd have used all the letters of the alphabet in trying to explain why he'd done what, unfortunately, he clearly did, and all the harm and distress he caused to others.
Patrick Mackay was certified a schizoid psychopath at the age of 15, and by the time he was 22, he'd committed unthinkable crimes. I find this case very disturbing, not just because he killed these people in such an horrific way, but I wonder if these murders could have been avoided
if the authorities had intervened earlier.